Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven. Hello and welcome back. Today I have the one and only Shay Kelly. Our paths haven't crossed until now, but I do know that we are both big black lab lovers. He's the daddy of pretty much all things canine enrichment. He is a multiple author and the dog world's worst kept secret that he runs the Dead Good Dog Trainer parody page, which I have enjoyed many giggles at. And so hello Shay, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
No worries. Yeah. Tell me a bit, I've seen that you've got black labs, so I've got to ask you about that first. So who have you got at home, and tell us a little bit about those first.
Now we've just got Monty, 2-year-old black lab, who's a very, very, very excitable black lab, who I've not actually done that much training with for me, being a training geek. We're only just starting now.
Okay. I've got a 1-year-old here, and I have started with her, but she's still, you know, she's a teenager, and it's eventful sometimes. I get it.
Very.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into it then. What are your biggest mistakes, mess-ups or learning points in your journey with dogs?
Well, I start with, as my first adult dog, I went to Waterworld, which is just off of the M25 on the A10, just going into London to buy a fish, because I used to keep tropical fish. And in this place, they had a little pet shop in the days when you could get dogs from pet shops. They had a pet shop within their grounds that just rented a bit of space off of them. So I went for a tropical fish and I came back with a German Shepherd. No planning, anything, no intentions on getting a dog, no discussion about getting a dog. I just went out to get a tropical fish and took home a German Shepherd puppy. Turned out to be underage, was only about 6 weeks old. It didn't work out at the time. The flat that I lived in, upstairs, with small children. So everything that could have gone wrong, really, but just through really good fortune in that she turned out to be just a fantastic dog, all worked out well.
So more luck than judgment.
Absolutely. Thinking back now, just thinking how it could have all gone wrong and all the things I've seen since then and just how amazing she was, really. I mean, that's no experience from me, living in an upstairs flat, and she's probably the easiest house training I've ever had with a dog. She just wanted to go outside, to go to the toilet. And considering her conditions she'd been kept in, she'd been brought from Wales, obviously puppy farmed, which we didn't work out at the time. We didn't even know what that was. And then kept in a sort of sterile greenhouse within another building so that people couldn't touch them and all that. So they wasn't even interacting with people or anything. She was just in there with a litter mate. And so it's absolutely amazing that she turned out as good as she did, but she was a very, very, very good dog. And that's what got me started.
How old were you when you went to get her? Sorry. How old were you when you went to get her?
It's going back about... My grown-up daughter now, who was about 6 months old at the time, and she's about 34 now, so it was quite a long time ago.
Okay, we'll leave it at that for ages then.
it should have been an absolute disaster, really. Mm. I didn't have any plans, any way of looking after her properly, anything, but it just all worked out brilliant. The one good thing was that I used to do night shifts, and so there was always someone there with the dog, so it wasn't like leaving her. But we put her in the kitchen when we went out, and that was it. We knew almost nothing really about looking after dogs.
I think there is a lot to, I have this discussion with friends quite often who are trainers and things, that sometimes when you're naive and you get that first dog or early in the days of your dog training career, you don't know a lot, but you can inadvertently, it goes really well. And in some ways, the more that you learn, the more you can get it wrong as much as you can get it right. What's your thoughts on that?
I didn't get much right at that time. It's just that for that start, it wasn't an absolute disaster. But really, you know, I look back now and I should have done a lot better for the dog. And, you know, I very much enjoyed having her, but I enjoyed the control and, you know, being able to get her to do this, that and the other. And we started a training group. It was before she was a year old, because I remember I remember the day I went in there and said, oh, she's 1 year old today. So that's how I remember it was long. It was before that. So she wasn't even a year old. And we was going to a German Shepherd training class just for German Shepherds, which just happened to be around the corner, run by a very old school type trainer. No treats in the class. Walking around in circles. Every dog in there had a choke chain on. And Sasha, my German Shepherd, lived her whole life with a choke chain on. And now I look at them and, you know, they make me sad inside when I see a dog with a choke chain on. But, you know, we didn't.
But it was of the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what you have to remember. Even now when I criticise other people, which now and again I've been known to do, you have to remember that if someone had said to me that that wasn't right, I'd have thought, you know, I'd have thought they were bonkers. I'd have thought, you know, there's something wrong with them to think that, because it was so commonplace and normal. And you listened to the trainer because, you know, they've got the position of authority. You believe what they're saying, just like you would believe a doctor, what they're saying.
Yeah.
But the more you learn, the more over the years you just, you know, it makes you shake your head at the things that you did. And I was, you know, I was quite soft. I, you know, they didn't have treats in the class, but I was already getting into dog training and sort of becoming a little bit obsessed with it. So I would go and do my own training throughout the week, where I use treats all the time. And I was, you know, reading books and just starting to dip my toe in the water of behaviour and that. But in the class, there was no treats allowed, nobody. But you look at that class, and so many times I thought about it. I don't remember a single dog, you know, and I was going there for a few years, that improved. We just went there. It was more of a, it's more of a social outing for the people, really, who had the dogs, because any dog that was whiny or didn't like being in there or was a little bit nippy or a little, you know, whatever the problem with the dog, that was still the problem with the dog a year or two later. None of that was ever addressed. It was just walk around in circles and do this, that and the other. So it's just, it really, really put me off training classes. That once I started to learn what, you know, a bit more about it, and for years later, not really at the time, I didn't think at the time it was terrible, but as I started to progress, it really put me off training classes, because that's all I had to go on. And I sort of thought there was all like that. And I'd tried a few more and they weren't much better over the years. There was probably worse, actually. One that I remember where they taught puppies to lay on the floor by pulling the hairs underneath their chin to make them lay down if they didn't lay down. So that sort of level. And they were seen as, you know, they had, these people had good reputations. They weren't seen as, you know, the way people talk about people who train like that now. Everyone thought they were brilliant and knew what they were doing.
Yeah. So with her, did you say her name was Sasha? Yeah. So with Sasha, other than going to these training classes, and it sounds like she's the one that kind of set you on the path that, you know, you're on now, did you face any kind of major behaviour issues with her, or what were the stumbling blocks with her? Other than the way you got her and hadn't planned for?
I didn't really. But that's, like I say, she was just an amazing dog. I think many other dogs I would, I mean, dogs I had after that, I probably had more problems with. So I was just really lucky. We did go to, I used to go to sort of minor shows and stuff, doing a bit of obedience and things like that. And she did run off around the car park once, and nobody could catch her because it was just an excited thing over the stop. But and now you see that, and it's sort of an excited escape from that control when they just need to release, and they're, you know, you're trying to confine them to what you want them to do, and it's not recognised their needs. But there was no major problems with her, but I was just extremely lucky. I mean, in them days, that's how different it's gone now, is that I was only thinking this the other day. We used to go on holiday and leave the dog at home, and we just had somebody coming in to feed her once or twice a day and let her out. And doesn't that just seem crazy now to think, oh, I'm just going to, I'd worry about my dog if I left him for a couple of hours. I don't know how I did that now. It's like you was a different person, or it's a different life.
I did similar with my first dogs, and I look and I wouldn't even dream of it now. And like you say, it feels like I was a different person then. And it's almost that I think we have a lot more recognition that they are sentient beings. They have emotions, and, you know, they are family. When I think I mean, even with my first big dog, there was a lot of that, you will do, you know, you will do what I say, and quite, and the control. And yeah, yeah. But it's amazing how things change with time and experience. And also, I think culture around dogs has definitely changed in you know, that 30 odd years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So your biggest mistake with her was the way she arrived, not being prepared. You know, you went to get a fish and you came back with a puppy. So take me from there. Where was your next mess up? Like, was it another dog or was it years and years later?
Yeah, no, with her, it's just the regret, really, rather than a mess up that, you know, I feel like I should have given her a better life. The next mess up, and probably my biggest regret ever in anything to do with dogs, is that we ended up getting her. We still had Sasha, but she was getting on a bit. She was about 14 years old, and we got a Daisy West Island Terrier. And I'd watched, I still wasn't a trainer, but I was becoming more interested in training and stuff. So we did end up going on to do lots and lots of different tricks with her and teaching her a lot of stuff, not serious stuff, but, you know, trick training and that. But because I was interested in training, it was an era where I'd watched rather too much of Cesar Millan on The Dog Whisperer. And so that was
kind of
my mindset. Even I wasn't aware of much criticism of him at that time. I'm not sure there was a lot. It was probably just starting. In fact, since then, I've learned that there was a lot of criticism right back to when his program started, and that Nat Geo was warned of, you know, these methods by professionals and stuff. But at the time, there wasn't much spoken about it. Nobody was really against him. They thought he was wonderful. And even now, when I look at any, I mean, I've not really watched it for years, but you look at any clips and the answer to everything just seems to be, you know, a little tap or a little poke and a like, it's just about stopping the dog doing what you don't want them to do. And that is it. No other consideration for that dog whatsoever. And that just, you know, nobody thought past it. Nobody thought it was cruel, because they didn't really, unless you think about it, it just makes sense. Oh, look, it stopped them doing it. So when we got Daisy, she was quite a whiner, as some terriers can be. And she hadn't been away from her mother long. And she was still at the stage of pining for the litter mates and stuff like that. And she would whine a lot. And my response was to do this, to tell her to stop. And I mean, that could make me cry now. It's so ridiculously awful. But that's why I warn other people now about this crap that people come out with. You know, it's just stuff that doesn't make sense if you critically evaluate it. It's just, but you don't think past that, a lot of people. That's the problem. You just think, oh yeah, look, it works. It shut the dog up. But that's just, you know, I mean, I've written a book about raising puppies in recent years. So to think that that is how I treated a puppy, it's just, it's an hard thing to even say or to admit. But I say it because I want other people to realise, you know, anyone can be sucked into believing this stuff. But you've really got to think about what you're doing, why you're doing it, what other things is it affecting, and think about the dog's needs. Because we're only ever, with balanced training or aversive training or whatever you want to call it, all you're ever thinking about is your own needs, really. And you're not considering the dog whatsoever.
No, it's very egocentrical.
And although we went on to do a lot with that dog, because I got about 4 years into her life, I really got into behaviour and training and started university degree, my first one, and really got hooked on dog behaviour then. So she was already about four at that time. And although we did a hell of a lot with her, and she was a really good dog, really, for a terrier, she was not too barky, or they do quite often like the sound of their own voice. She wasn't, she was a pretty good dog, but I always felt that that connection was missing. And I mean, it might just be my head, but I always felt like she resented it. And she was always closer to my wife than to me. She preferred women. And that's probably my doing. I probably did that. She used to like sitting on your lap. But if my wife was sat on a chair as well, she'd use my legs to walk up on, and then she'd go across and sit on my wife's lap. But she hadn't been involved with training or anything, you see. So she was probably much more relaxed with her.
No, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I totally relate to what you're saying about having these regrets, and that, you know, times have moved on, and, you know, your knowledge base has obviously grown massively, as has mine, and that we do these things at the time, like you say, you don't question it, you don't evaluate it, you don't think about the fallout, and we take other people's word as law. And it's still happening now with, you know, many dog owners and things like that, how they'll take TV programs, for example, and do exactly the same without questioning anything. I think in some ways it's part of everyone's journey, but it's also waking up and realizing, and that's quite often the hardest bit, and then living with the guilt. But that's what this podcast is all about, is lessening the guilt that we've all kind of been there, even, you know, the best of us, and done all these awful things. Well, not all these awful things, but done awful things, which now we know so much better, and it's trying to help others avoid that. I mean, with, and having that kind of gap in that relationship with a dog, I've seen that, I've felt that before, and I don't think that ever goes away. With certain dogs, there's always that. You love them, you want to do the best by them, you've learned, you've been on a journey while you've had them, but the dog doesn't forget.
No, well, that's the thing. That's one of the things that was mentioned quite a few times at university during my studies, is that you can't unlearn something, and that goes for the dog as well. So once they've experienced something, right, you might make life much better for them later on, but those things that happened are still part of their journey. They're still part of their learning history. They still affect them. They still know, you know, people who respond badly to them, they still know that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. I'd rather they never knew you could react like that.
Yeah, yeah. They do teach us to be the best versions of ourselves, I think. But yeah. Okay, so is there any more on Daisy?
Well, the only other is really Daisy and Sasha, but it's more for Sasha, the German Shepherd, because like I said, she was quite old when we got Daisy. And getting in a puppy when you've got a 14-year-old German Shepherd who's now struggling to get around on their hips and all the rest of it that we suffer in old age is a terribly bad idea. The number of people that have spoken to me over the years since I've, you know, been into dog training and been doing dog training and come up with the exact same problem of, you know, their dog's getting old. Before they pass on, they go out and get a new puppy, but they've left it too long, really, for that older dog. They want a quiet retirement, not a puppy jumping all over them. Mm-hmm. So they end up getting a bit narky with the puppy, and, you know, it's just not a good relationship, and it's stressful for them. And I think it helps if there's nothing wrong with pups being around older dogs, but I think it helps if you've got more dogs in the house where it's more, you know, the attention is more split onto the maybe middle-aged dogs or something like that. So I don't think I would ever advise somebody to get a pup while they've got an older dog, because it's just not fair on the, you know, the geriatric dog once they're past playing and not interested. She hadn't shared stuff her whole life. She wasn't used to that. She didn't like the puppy having stuff. She didn't like the puppy interacting with her or trying to play with her, not even in the slightest. I don't just mean when they get too much. She was having none of it. And she was a dog that liked other dogs all her whole life. But she hadn't been used to another dog in her space. It was just totally unrealistic and unfair to bring this dog into this situation. And so I think that probably does happen a lot, because, like I say, people start to feel, maybe my dog's only got a year or two left, and they get a puppy. And sometimes they think, oh yeah, they've got a connection between the two then, and it'll carry on. And but you've got to think of both dogs, really, and what's best for them. And so I mean, there may be situations where you can make it work, but I it's not advisable to do. I think I'd try to avoid it at all costs.
I think that's a really good point to make. I have these obviously I've specialized in multi-dog households, so I have these conversations with clients and people quite regular, and I have brought a dog in, I don't think at 14, but, like, you know, I brought a puppy in when one's older, but as you say, I've had multiple dogs, like, not just the old one, and it is, you know, having the middle-aged ones to deflect that attention away with the puppy is definitely helpful. But yeah, I'm very much for letting the old dog retire in peace, because I think there is, at certain ages, you know, that people say, oh well, I brought the puppy in and the old dog's got a new lease of life, and it's like, great, You know, you're obviously that you've done it before the dog's quite got to that stage of they're old and absolutely past it. But it's, I think it's a gamble. So yeah, I totally agree that with, if you've got multiple dogs, as in more than two, then great. If you can make it work, great. But a lot of it is down to management and ensuring that the old dog can have its own space, get away from the tiny little needle teeth hanging on its tail, and have enough space mentally as much as physically to have that downtime away from that puppy. And I do think there is a lot to be said of waiting. I get that people would, you know, you don't want to be without a dog. I get that. You know, you're going to lose your dog. You don't want to be without a dog, full stop. I understand that. But is it fair when you've given 14 years, for example, to this dog's life for its last year, whatever, to be overshadowed by having a puppy?
Yeah, and it's not always as simple as that. I mean, there's things you can do, like giving the older dog a safe space, which is always recommended, but it's not always as simple as that, because I've had people that have done that, and then the older dog doesn't like that. The older dog wants to do their thing, and it's just there barking because you've now tried to create this, what you're calling a safe space, but for them, they're being excluded to somewhere
else. It's prison.
Doesn't always work. No, totally
with you on that. Like, for what I meant by that, like, I totally get you what you're saying. It's more a case of, you know, you've got to prepare in, like, things. If you're going to do it, prepare long in advance. So this is part of the norm for the old pup. It's for the old dog. It's not that you're going to get shut in that room, which you never get shut in that room until this puppy arrives, because then it's just like prison. And it's not fair. It's not fair at all. But yeah, thanks for raising that point. I don't think we've covered the kind of old dog, new dog in the podcast yet. So, and it's a very valid point to make. But I think unless you've done it, you don't see it. So I get that totally. So with, okay, so Sasha just wasn't tolerant at all, which, understandable. We live and learn. How was Daisy when Sasha went? Any
went
different
past away,
or
then.
Not? Yes.
Barely noticed. There was nothing at all, really. No, she didn't. She wouldn't have pined. I think she just enjoyed the freedom of being able to move without being pounced on. I mean, Sasha never hurt her, but she would come and close her down, like, you know, what you're doing, what you're touching, what you're, you know, like that sort of attitude. And Daisy would come back and sort of in submission. But they never hurt each other. It was just no enjoyment.
No. Wow. Interesting. Okay. Any more mistakes along the way? I'm sure there's plenty, but any more that you want to cover?
Now we move on to Barney, who was my yellow lab. I could live for 5,000 years and I'd never have another Barney. He was just that, you know what people say, heart dog. He was just the most amazing dog ever. He's the one that really got me into training, because I did so much with him. I just fell in love with training, fell in love with labs, all the rest of it, and started university while he was just about a year old. So he was just at a good age to be my uni dog and to do all the training and stuff that I had to do at home, and projects and all sorts of things. And we just did so much, just the best time. But looking back now, even makes me want to cry now thinking about it. It's just so brilliant. But looking back, when we got him, he brought him home at 8 weeks, or whatever it was, 8.5 weeks. And we'd been to see him a few times first, so he knew us. We'd been to visit the litter 3 or 4 times from when he was 2 weeks old. But when we brought him home, we went along the traditional route of putting him in a crate and leaving him downstairs to cry it out. And like I say, I've written a book about it. I've learned so much along the journey. I just got so much regret about that. And he didn't, you know, he turned out to really be a brilliant dog. So it didn't, it's not that it caused him long-term harm. He never suffered, you know, any anxieties or anything particularly. But, you know, to listen to him, I can still hear it now, all these years later, you know, the distress of, you know, at the time you just think, oh yeah, they're just making a noise, they've got to get used to it, and, you know, but they've just been taken away from the only life they've ever known. Their mother, their human carer, their other litter mates. They've gone into a completely new environment where they know nobody. They've never been in this environment before. And that evening, you lock them in a room, you lock them in a crate in a room and leave them for 8 hours or whatever it is. And to my mind now, that just, I mean, a lot of people probably listen to this and think, yeah, well, that is the way you do it. They've just got to get used to it because people still do it now. It is starting to change, but still a hell of a lot of people that do that. And they say, oh, if you don't leave them, they'll get separation anxiety and all the rest of it. And there might be, you know, there might be some truth. So you do have to, if you're going to be leaving them, because, you know, a lot of us have got to go to work and we have got to leave dogs. But the time isn't when you've just brought them home, just to leave them, to cry it out. I mean, that distress is just, it's just
panic.
Even if it doesn't cause long-term harm, it's not right. It's not right to let him go through that distress. And for what a great dog he was to me, I mean, he changed my life. You know, I wouldn't have gone to university or anything if I hadn't got Barney, Mr. B, as I used to call him. And for all he did for me, and he did make me look like a really good trainer at university because he just seemed to know what I wanted. So everyone thought I was much better than I really was. I just have to think about something. Can he seem to know? I don't know how he did it. He was just perfect for that stage of my life. But to think back now and think I let him go through that distress, it's just, you know, it's a massive, massive regret. And it's not something I would ever do again with a dog.
And you've obviously not done it in that way since.
No, Monty was the next one. And I even showed my setup on online, on social media. We had, it wasn't a crate, but it was like a pen without a lid on it that I put next to the bed. And that's where I had him. I'd actually planned to be, you know, sitting on the floor next to him and sort of sleep on the floor so I could have my arm in there easier. Although he was right next to my, you know, the bed as close as you could be. But I still thought that might be too much for him, right? But it wasn't. I was able to just sleep in the bed and he settled down in there right next to me and he was absolutely fine. Never whined once for his family. His mother, he'd lived with his father as well because the breeder had both dogs. So he'd come from a litter where he was very, very, very well looked after. They had children and he used to sit on their lap. And so they had a lot going on. Really, you know, comfortable and enjoyable puppyhood. And he'd come into my home and you've got a lot of responsibility there. And so I'm very, very, it's one of the things I'm probably proudest of is that he never pined for them at all. He just settled right in as if he'd always been here.
It's nice. It's nice when that happens.
But he never whined once during the night. He was just absolutely brilliant. But that's your journey, isn't it? You're learning as you're going along. You know, it's developing all the time. It's all, you couldn't possibly start off like that. Because where does the learning come from? It's just everybody's on a journey and in a different place. And that is what you have to remember. Even criticizing people, you have to remember that, you know, we're all in a different place.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. We're all on different paths. We're all on a different stage in our journeys. Every journey will be different. And you don't know what you don't know until you know. Okay, so are there any other big stories you want to share?
Yeah, with Barney, really, all I'd say is that we did, and I was just getting into clicker training. That was a massive, massive thing then. It's died down a little bit now, and I don't even do that much of it, a little bit. But it had become a huge thing, just like when I was starting uni and was learning about it at uni and all the rest. And it was almost like it was magical, you know. And I'm quite an obsessive person as well. So we got into trick training and we just, I mean, he must have known hundreds of tricks. But right from really young, from, you know, first days that I had him, he was learning and he was doing tricks and he was, you know, training. There's probably not a day we didn't train in the first 4 years of his life. And really, I look back, although he was a brilliant dog, so you can't have regrets in that way. But I feel now that I probably did too much with him and too much was about me and the food that I've got and rather than him developing some self-confidence or just developing himself really and having independence and confidence in that way. So he would always throughout his life look to me for everything. You know, if there was another dog ahead, he'd look at me. And you might say, oh, that's great. But he never really made any decisions for himself. It was always, what are we doing now then? You know, like that. And
Dad?
Many dogs do it, but he followed me absolutely everywhere. If, you know, I've got a sped up video, a time-lapse video somewhere of when I was doing the decking out in the garden and from the security cameras. And like, so it was like a 3 week project or anything. And when you look at it back, you just notice that every time I'm there doing it, he's there behind me. He's just like, no matter what I was doing, if I'm in the garden, he'd be in the garden. If I, you know, wherever I was, he would be there. And then Monty's not like that at all. I can be in the garden and he might come out and see if I'm doing anything, but then he'll come in and settle down and do whatever he wants as much. So I see now that he's got much more independence, really, and I quite like that.
Hmm.
So I do feel, I can't say it was a massive problem, but I think sometimes you can overtrain with dogs and take a bit of agency away in that way, really.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you're right in that a lot of people would say, well, you know, that's a good thing, is looking to you for guidance and asking what's next and all of this. But yeah, I do like a dog that can make their own decisions and can have that individuality. Yeah.
Yeah. I just worry now that maybe it wasn't the best thing for his life. Maybe, you know, a bit more independence would have been an addition to the good life that he
had. Yeah. I think it's a sliding scale with all dogs, isn't it, really? You get dogs that are hyper-independent and are a little bit harder to motivate to do what you want to do. And then you get the dogs that are, like, totally attached to you and like, yeah, let's do it, let's do it, let's do it. But yeah, and I think that every person is going to have a different ideal on that spectrum of what is ideal for them, because we're all different, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And all the dogs are different. You know, what some need are very different to what others need, and that's the thing to consider. I think we all get dogs, and whenever somebody gets a dog, it's always you can't help it. You've got a story in your mind almost of why you want them, what you're going to do with them. You might be wanting to do agility, you might be wanting to do shows, you might be wanting to walk on the beach, you might be wanting to meet up with your friends or sit in a cafe, or, you know, there's thousands of different stories that we can attach, but we've not even met the dog half the time, and we've already made this life for them, which, you know, might not be suitable. I mean, I used to train for dog aid for a little while and assistance in disability. The big downside to that is these are dogs that the person who wants an assistance dog has already got.
The dog.
Guide dogs, where they're bred for it for years and years and years and got the right genetics. And it's not always the right thing for them, you know. And I feel, you know, they're quite constrained, some of them, to this life that we put them in.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you with that, with when people, I mean, I've got friends who are dog aid trainers and I get it. It's the, I couldn't imagine actually going out and to, you know, being, say, for example, I was a dog aid trainer, that of going out and being like, okay, you've got this totally unsuitable dog for this totally unsuitable task for them, but you've got this, like, your whole world is wrapped up in this vision. And it must be absolutely devastating for those people to actually come to terms with the fact that it's not going to happen with that dog. And some, you know, of course, there are success stories. I've seen them all the time. But it's the others that I feel for, of they don't understand why, and that, you know, you're never going to get certain dogs to do tasks and be confident in every situation because genetically, or, you know, because of their rearing, because of trauma, because of like a multitude of things, it's just not going to be them.
I had one client who, and her dog was really good. That was a black lab, years and years ago. But was really, really good dog. But what she failed to realise was she, you know, you don't know what you don't know, like you said. And she couldn't see the stress when people was coming up and touching her dog that I spotted straight away. So the dog wasn't happy in those environments where she wanted to take the dog. And even now, I think, I often think back, Barney probably would have suited anybody, you know, as long as you weren't, as long as it weren't an aversive trainer, because he hated anything. Any aggression, any raised voice, any anything, he would shrink out of the way. Nothing to do with it. If a dog had a go at him, he'd have walked away. He had not an ounce of aggression. I've actually got a photo of him somewhere with sniffing a butterfly, hurt it, just sniffed it and let it fly off. He would have suited so many different types of home. But then other dogs that I've had, including Monty that I've got now, you think so easily. You know, we label these dogs with problems all the time. And Daisy would have been another one because she had some resource guarding issues, really quite bad when she was a puppy. That you think, in many homes, they'd have just been rehomed as a problem dog. And in Monty's case, he just gets excited very, very, very easily. And, you know, that's pretty much why we've not done a lot of training. I mean, we've done the important stuff, like, you know, feeling safe and being able to socialise with other dogs and all the rest of it. But we haven't actually done any, you know, formal training or trick training or anything like that, because he within a second, his mind's up there and jumping about and I've got a video somewhere of him getting overexcited in the garden, and I just put my hand out to do like a hand target touch to calm him down. That was supposed to be the intention, and he just flies past me in excitement and grabs my hand as he goes, which hurt quite a lot and could have been far worse. So,
just enthusiasm and being totally over, like, oh my God, so excited.
But is it the dog who's got a problem, or is it that they're just in the wrong environment for that animal? And quite often, put that dog in a different environment and they're absolutely fine. They would never have had a problem. Yet we're labelling them with this problem and that problem and the other problem so easily, because we desperately want them to fit into this story we've made up about how they should live.
Yeah. Yeah, you're spot on there. I think we all do it to a certain extent of, right, I'm going to get this dog and it's going to have this job and this is what I'm going to do with it. And I'd say probably more so trainers than... But you know, people working with dogs than the normal pet dog owners, and because we usually have some kind of goal in mind. But I find that, you know, life and the dog and everything else has different plans half the time, and a lot of it is how well we adapt to that change in path. But I wouldn't say it's easy.
No, I think the more you fall in love with behaviour, the easier it gets, because you can enjoy that process of, oh, this isn't working with this dog. And that's another easy mistake to fall into. And I did it with Barney, because he was so good. He was better than I was at training, because he was so good. And I was doing uni and I was doing well, and everything was going brilliantly, and I was getting top marks and I had a top dog. We had a uni assignment on my first degree, the foundation degree, where you had to do quite complex, I don't know, about 30 different behaviours, and they're quite complex. And we got 100% grade on the practical part of that, which had never been done before, but that's just, he was an exceptional dog. I forgot the point of why I was telling you that now.
I finished up by kind of saying that, you know, it's sometimes the dog and life has different plans, and it's how well we adjust to those different plans. And then you started talking about Barney.
Yeah, I was just saying, but how good he was just naturally seemed to be. It can lead you into a false sense of security yourself, and you can start thinking you're actually a better trainer than you are. And then you come across, you know, a client's dog or another dog, or someone asks you about their dog, and you find yourself doing these things that you do with your own dog, and it's like, why aren't they responding? You're supposed to do this. You know, they're not that dog. They're a totally different dog. But you can, it sounds silly, but you can, you know, you can forget and like I say, get in a false sense of security. So you've always got to be totally open with, you know, with every dog. There isn't a recipe to, so many times people, I mean, I get hundreds of messages online and emails and stuff, because I do social media and a blog, and of people asking me how they fix this, that or the other. It's very, very difficult, you know, when you've never even met the dog, because all you've got is that person's very short interpretation of what the problem is. You haven't seen anything, you know, 10 people who looked at that situation would see it slightly differently, and 10 people would explain it slightly differently, and other people would understand that explanation differently. So it's very difficult just to write a recipe, and that's the difficulty about writing books, is you've got, it's the downside really, because you've got to keep it open to as many possibilities as possible, and understand that people will read it differently to how you intended it, differently to how other people read it. Their interpretations are different because they're all on different paths and got different histories. So you always got to bear that in mind. Yeah. And that's what makes it, well, it's what makes it interesting and difficult at the same time.
It is. When I've got 3 books out, and on my last one, I mean, they all need updating now, because you learn more and you move on and you go, oh, I'm not sure I can stand behind that anymore. But, you know, when I was in the last one, there's loads of exercises in there. It's basically the first year with your puppy. And there's loads of exercises that I've written out. Step one, do this. Step two, do this. And it was so hard writing those, because you have to leave it open to so many different parameters and people and dogs and all of this that, you know, I know that that's not going to work for every dog, but you have to try and cover as many bases as you can and hope that it will reach most, rather than, because you're never going to reach all, because like everything in training and behavior, it depends. That's the answer to most things. It depends.
That's the biggest thing, is not wanting to be misunderstood. See, and that's quite difficult to do, because you just you know, you're talking to everyone you don't know. Same with social media. The downside is you're talking to everyone, and people are going to misunderstand what you say, and some people are going to purposely misunderstand what you say, and some people are going to be offended, and some people are going to find it funny, and some people, it's just everybody. But in reality, in real life, I don't talk to my mum the way I talk to my boss, or the way I talk to my mate while you're having a drink, or, you know, you change who you are. That's, you know, and that's not being authentic. It's just you change for the situation you're in. Of course you do. But on social media, you're putting that same one message out to absolutely everybody. So that's the difficulty with it.
It is. But I think that's a good point as well, what you've just made with, you know, we are different people to different people, depending on the situation. And that goes back to the dogs, that we labeled them with these, you know, issues, because in that situation, that's what we are seeing. But then put them in a different situation, different environment, different home, with a different person, whatever, you're going to see a different dog.
Yeah, absolutely. And the most basic example of it being the environment and not the animal is just when you look at polar bears and their environment changing, and it's now becoming not suitable for them. But the animal is the same animal. It just can't evolve fast enough for the environment. And that's what we've done to dogs, really. We're putting them in situations that they haven't been pets all that long, but, you know, companion animals, should I say, or, you know, was only about the time of my childhood, really. And even those dogs, they weren't at home in the day. They were let out in the morning and they went off and did what they wanted to do. So it's very, very new evolutionary time, or genetic time, or whatever you want to call it, for us to keep them in this real safety bubble that we do now, for obviously good reasons, but it's not necessarily right for them. And you just think how much that can change from one home to another is absolutely phenomenal. You know, some people are living on a farm with acres and acres of land for their dog to run around on. Some people are living in a flat. So it's just, you know, and we've all got different attitudes and different needs and different work needs. And just, it's nearly always the environment. That's the problem.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Okay. So before we wrap up, what are your top three pieces of advice or things for people to avoid in their life with dogs?
God, should have thought about that one, shouldn't I? Well, I think...
Don't buy a puppy when you're going to buy a fish.
I love that as number one, sure. Or at least tell your wife you're going to do it. I think the biggest thing, really, for me, is the thing that always comes back to, is to just try to understand life from the dog's perspective. And that's not... That covers so many things, but some of us don't even consider other humans' needs. So trying to get everyone to consider the needs of their dog is quite a big ask sometimes, and we all see it completely differently. If two people are looking at a sunset or anything, each person's experience is slightly different. So to get in the mind of a dog is not possible to know exactly how they see life, but that doesn't stop us trying. We all share the same base emotions. We've got fear and all the anxieties and the joy. So it's not, dogs are not all that different. If we just take the time to consider what the experience might be for them rather than, you know, what we want. And I just think it makes the biggest difference you can ever imagine to do that. The other big thing I would say is the puppy thing, really, is that you can't really get those years back. Doesn't mean we can't try or make life good, or if we've made mistakes, because we all do it. But just those early days, I just think remembering where this dog came from, like I say, again, it comes down to seeing it from their perspective. But, you know, it's exciting for a human when they get a puppy. We're thinking about it for weeks. We're thinking about the day that they're going to arrive. But stop that and think about the dog. What is it for the dog? For the puppy, it's lost. It's just
traumatic.
Everything that it knows, everything, their whole life has just gone, and they're now here. What are they to make of that? And really, it's miraculous that they get on so well.
It is. It is. Okay. Thank you. I think they're really good tips. Absolutely cracking. So would you like to share with the listeners kind of about your books, how they can reach you, anything that you offer?
Books, well, I don't offer much, really. Books. I've just got them here to remind me. Look, I wrote them. I've got to remind me. So Puppy Nurture is the newest one. And that's That's probably the one I'm most proud. I should have started at the beginning, really, because I did Canine Enrichment first. So Canine Enrichment was my first book. It wasn't the book I always wanted to write. I did always have a sort of pipe dream that I'd like to write a book one day. I never thought it would happen. And then I started the Canine Enrichment group, and it was just the right thing at the right time, and it absolutely snowballed into something massive. And now it was the first ever one at the time. But now there's hundreds of similar groups. So it's all died down a bit. It's not all on me, thank God. But that's why I wrote the book, just because of the popularity of that group. And I was just swamped with questions, mm-hmm. and I was suddenly expected to be the expert on canine enrichment. So I wrote a book answering all the questions, and then I rewrote it recently. So it was the second edition now, which is this one. First one had Barney on the cover. Now I've got Monty on the cover, my current dog.
No.
Because I was still studying at the time when I wrote the first one, and there was a lot more that I went on to learn about agency and stuff like that. And it's always a regret, like you said, about your books. You think, now, would you write it like that? There was too much in there that I thought, there was too much more that I wanted to say about it. And then Dog Training and Behaviour, a Guide for Everyone, was really the book that I always wanted to write. It's the sort of book that I wanted when I was just starting to learn, because it's got all the technical stuff in it as well. But even that, I'd probably write it a little bit different now, and it'd be maybe a little bit softer. But it's got a hell of a lot of information in that one if you're starting a course or something like that, because it's all the training systems explained and all that. And then Puppy Nurture, which isn't, I don't really think of it as a training book. I think of it more as the subtitle is Raising Your Puppy with Love. So more their development and stuff like that, a more relaxed way of raising a dog rather than do this and that and the other. So it's not really a training book like that. So that's the one I was most pleased with, because I'll never sell many copies, because it's only self-published. It doesn't get any publicity, really. There are hundreds of puppy books. They just flood the market, because that's when people are buying, when they get a puppy. That's when they go out and get stuff. And there's so much crap. I mean, I know you're not supposed to put other people's stuff down, but there's just so much rubbish. And I have honestly, I've got, you see my books on my shelf up there. I mean, I've got hundreds of books. Every puppy book I've ever read, I've not been totally happy with. There's always problems. Even the better ones, there's things I think, oh, that's awful. There's always something. And many are truly awful. Even some of them are the best-selling books in the country on puppies. One of them, I'm not going to name who it is, but one of them, their idea to solve separation anxiety is just to shut the puppy in a room and let them get on with it. It's just bonkers. Another book tells you to, I looked through these when I was researching my own book. Another book tells you that if you put a puppy in a crate, they'll never get separation anxiety. That's it. You just, because they've got used to being shut in a crate. I mean, it's just ridiculous that it's just lack of critical evaluation completely. And so fresh out of getting my master's degree, critical evaluation is something that I do quite well. I just think like that all the time. So I just thought we needed for my own sake, more than anything, I needed to write my own book. So I honestly, I know everyone thinks their own books are good, but honestly, I think Puppy Nurture is the best puppy book that's out there.
Noted. I'll have to get a copy. Have a nosy. But yeah. Cool. Do you offer any kind of, do you do any workshops or anything like that that you want to share with everyone? Or have you got a website where you can get your books from other than Amazon? Do you sell them
No, they're only really on Amazon. I do, sometimes people don't want to use Amazon and I send them to them myself, but if they contact me directly and pay me for them, but that's all really. I have got a website, but it's mainly a blog, shaykelly.com. And then you can find me on Canine Enrichment and Shay Kelly on Facebook. Shay Kelly Understanding Dogs is my sort of training page. But really, I'm mainly retired and I don't do a lot of hands-on training anymore. I've done a bit for Grisha Stewart. I've got a course on her academy and a few other places where I've got courses or where I've done a talk, and they sell it as a little course thing. But I don't do my own ones. I'm not really a business person. I don't really run it as a business. It's always just been a passion and a hobby, and I still work outside of the industry. I've still got a separate job outside of the industry, which I keep saying I'm going to leave, but I'm still there some bloody reason.
Thank you for me,
more of a passion.
And I can see that, and I'm sure the listeners will be able to hear that And but I've really enjoyed this chat. I really have. And I will put the links to your website and the books and stuff in the show notes for the listeners if they want to order books and things like that. But yeah, thank you very much for joining me. And yeah, I will be back for the listeners next week. Thank you, Shay.
Thanks very much.
I wanted to take a second to make you an offer. An offer to join my membership. This is on WhatsApp and you get weekly videos of things to work on, new themes each month, 2 turbo training calls a week where we all train together on WhatsApp and work on what you want to get that progress and accountability, monthly catch-up calls, and so much more. Ideal for if you get a bit stuck or you keep putting off the training with your dog, and absolutely perfect if you're on your journey into dog sports too. I am offering you, my wonderful listener, the chance to get in and try it out for free for a whole month. Drop me a message on socials or email me, sarah@multidogmaven.co.uk. That's sarah@multidogmaven.co.uk, and get the link to get in. Don't be shy, reach out, I would love to hear from you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again, and we'll be back next week.